Okay, we'll call the committee to order. Welcome everybody to the Commerce and Financial Institutions Committee. We've got a lot of new members here, both who have been in the legislature before and also freshmen, so going to have a few overviews the next few days. But first, I'd like to just have everybody introduce themselves. If you're a member, tell everybody where you represent. District numbers mean absolutely nothing to me, so if you could say cities. And then as we go around, if staff would introduce yourself and tell what your role is, and Mr. Freeman should be with us in a moment. Representative Hollis, you want to start at that end? No? Representative Yaros.
Yeah, Mike Yaros from Duluth. You're up.
Yep. Joe Atkins in Monroe Heights. Glad to be here.
Frank Moe, Bemidji over to Deer River, all Leaf Lake Reservation.
Duke Powell, Burnsville, Savage.
Rod Hamilton, Windham, Worthington, Jackson, Mountain Lake area.
Joyce Pepin, Maple Grove, Rogers, Corcoran, Hessen, Dayton, Greenfield, Hanover.
Judy Satterstrom, Mora, Hinckley, Sandstone, Pine City.
I'm Elizabeth Long from the House Research Department, and I'll be staffing labor and employment issues for this committee.
I'm Tom Pender from House Research, and I'll be doing everything except labor and employment issues.
Paul Gazelka, Brainerd and most of Crowley County.
Andy Gilde, House Staff.
Tim Wilkin, I represent Egan and Burnsville.
And Paul Cole, represent Central and Western Carver County and part of Scott County.
Greg Davis, represent Fillmore and Houston Counties. I border Iowa and Wisconsin, so I'm the ambassador for the Iowa and Wisconsin.
We don't have any wars yet?
Not yet.
Okay, good.
It's in the valley.
Tony Sertich, Iron Range, all the way down to Duluth in St. Louis County.
Bob Gunther, I'm from Fairmont, opposite side of the state from Tony.
I'm Diane Loeffler, and I'm honored to represent Northeast Minneapolis.
Rita Saylor from Park Rapids. I've got most of Hubbard, or half of Hubbard, most of Beltrami, most of Clearwater, and a little bit of Polk and Pennington counties. And there's good snow up there, by the way.
Good afternoon, Tina Liebling. I represent 30A in Rochester, roughly the southern part of the city. Mayo Clinic is in my district.
Barb Goodwin. I represent Columbia Heights, Ridley, Hilltop, and St. Anthony.
Patty Frist, I live in Faribault, Minnesota. I represent parts of Rice and parts of Steele County.
Larry House, Walker, Minnesota, home of the U-Pop Festival and Moon Dance Jam. And I want to thank Representative Moe. During his campaign and since he got elected, he's been able to reach across party lines, and he will attend the U-Pop Festival and actually let the other party know that he's in town, unlike Representative Sertich of a year ago who went to the U-Pop Festival and didn't tell anybody he was there.
Do you have to eat that?
No. That's not the idea.
Okay, there's... we also have two subcommittees this year. Representative Powell will be chairing the, I guess it's the Tourism Division. And Representative Coles will have the, what are we calling that thing? Bioscience and Medical Products Division. So I think everybody knows who's on that at this point. I think before we get to the first, the Commerce Department overview, Mr. Pender has a short kind of briefing on what the jurisdiction of the committee is, because since it's quite broad. Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair, I have a handout here. If Paige could come and hand this out. Didn't get this done in time to be in the packets. As Representative Wilkins said, the jurisdiction of this committee is very broad, and in some past years its jurisdiction was spread among a number of different separate committees. I'll just quickly go through the sheet here that I handed out. Insurance is a big part of the work of this committee, and I just list here the main types of insurance. Then another big area is what I called here other financial institutions. And I use the word other because increasingly insurance is being considered to be simply one type of financial institution. And you can see that the types of financial institutions here are very broad, ranging from banks to pawn shops and credit unions and so on. Then another sort of financial area is securities regulation, meaning sale of investment products. And then there is a whole list of regulated occupations and professions that are within the jurisdiction of this committee. And you can see there's a great range of them there, ranging from residential building contractors to insurance agents, barbers and cosmetologists, and even athlete agents. And then we have labor and employment within the jurisdiction of this committee, including two departments that we're going to be hearing from later this week, the Department of Labor and Industry and the Department of... I always forget one of those E's. Department of Employment and Economic Development. And then we have a great variety of miscellaneous areas, and I list some of them there at the bottom. And each of those includes a somewhat unpredictable group of bills, whatever ends up being introduced. And a large part of our work is in that final item there, miscellaneous business laws and regulation. As I say at the top of the page, the committee's jurisdiction is policy issues as opposed to finance issues. And I believe that the finance jurisdiction for everything this committee deals with is Representative Gunther's finance committee. And obviously the committee's jurisdiction overlaps with other committees on certain of these subject areas. So anyway, this is a brief introduction to the jurisdiction of the committee and what it does.
Mr. Freeman, if you could just introduce yourself and what you do.
Good afternoon, members and other people. My name is Robert Freeman. I'm the legislative assistant for this committee and also for Representative Walken.
And while we go back, we've got some new people come in. Representative Mullery, you're the EFL lead. Do you want to introduce yourself and where you're from?
Joe Mullery from North App and North Minneapolis.
And cool. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Karen Clark from Three Neighborhoods in South Minneapolis.
Tom Rukavina, I represent, I'm the only legislator in the range delegation that represents the entire Iron Range.
Yeah. Dan Simpson represents Sac Rapids Sartell Strings.
And also our committee page, if you could just wave people at Dan Lusting. He's available for your services. Commissioner Wilson, might as well begin the overview of the Department of Commerce. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Could you please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your overview or your comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Glenn Wilson, the Commissioner of the Commerce Department. Chairman Wilkins, members of the Commerce Committee, I'm pleased and honored to be here to give a report on the department today, and I'm looking forward to working with all of you on this committee. And as Mr. Pender already pointed out, we do cover a wide range of activity and interest that covers or affects the life of almost every Minnesotan every day, meaning that it's important working together that the committee, the work of this committee and our department is very important, and we take it as such. I would like to start off too by telling you that what some of my perceptions are when I came into the department, regardless of my background. I found that the people are talented, hardworking, And they were no different than the people that I found in the 40 years of private business. They get up every morning with the expectation of doing the best job that they know how, perform and outperform expectation. And what I didn't understand, and I think is important to this committee, is when I came on board, I found that there were experts throughout the department covering the entire breadth of our responsibility, whether it's an actuary, an economist, or a specialist. So that I think that you can do, as I have done, almost once to twice every day, look to the department for a special report, special information, and I've not been let down one time. So with that kind of an introduction, I would hope that you would keep that in mind as an outstanding resource going forward. The other observation that I would like to make that makes this job much different than my business experience is that the department is more focused on policy and less on process. And I think that you'll find from my report that over the last 2 years that we've tried to spend a little bit more time on process than has been in the past. And the report, I hope, will reflect that. From a regulatory perspective, our mission really is to provide the best background and information that we possibly can to ensure an equitable commercial and financial marketplace, and the same for reliable energy services. We investigate and resolve consumer complaints by the thousands, and we advocate before the Public Utilities Commission on behalf of the consumers. We have a broad area of activity such as the unclaimed property, Petro Fund, and issues like that I'll cover in my report briefly. We have a dedicated and seasoned perspective in the department, frankly, that I'm very proud of. And I did want to just give this some perspective in terms of finance. Our revenue is in the neighborhood of $215 million annually. And our expenses are in the neighborhood of $160 million. That's and the revenue comes from several sources: the federal government assessments against regulated industries and fees, mostly from licensing. From a general fund perspective, revenue is very close to $100 million, and our expense about $28 million. So just doing the quick math, the surplus to the general fund generated by our departments in the neighborhood is $72 million. I'd like to go through the separate areas of activity so that you have just a slight perspective and Mike kind of an overview of each of those areas. First, in administration, we have Mike Blasek heading up that area. He's been with the department for 34 years, had been in weights and measures for a long time before coming into administration, where he heads up the IT area with Catherine Hennessy, the human resources area, Julie Lindberg, and the accounting department, where Min Stoll has been the director of finance for many years. First of all, I wanted to focus on the weights and measures area of the department. And I think that too little attention is given to this area. It's headed up by Carol Hawkett. Carol came to the department in 1994, was promoted to director in 1999, has a chemistry degree from the University of Minnesota. This department, frankly, is a world-class department. And the recognition, I think, in my report will verify that that's the case. When you look at the activity of the department, first of all, that you need to know, and you're Carol, back up a second. Carol is the vice president of the National Association of Laboratory, and it's got about an eight word, but it's in my report that you all get. But the recognition of Carol's capability is known by the fact, too, that she alone, for the most part, will bring the international conference, 1,200-member conference, International Laboratory Technicians, to the St. Paul in 2007. As another example of the kind of work and recognition that area gets, that 19 other states, the USDA, and 600 businesses in our state are dependent on the work of our metrology lab, principally. So that when you think about the recognition given, another example that I like to cite is some of you were involved in the passage of the diesel fuel, the new 2%, the B2, that includes animal fat and soybean mix. Most people didn't know, but there's no way to test that that is the case. It will fall back on our metrology lab and the Weights and Measures Department to be able to assure the public that that, in fact, is the blend that they're getting. The first couple months, I was told that this was going to be a very difficult task. Within just a couple months after that, I was told by Carol that the task had been completed, and now there's a good chance that it'll be the national standard. So I've spent maybe a little bit more time, but I think that some of this is very important. It's the only opportunity that I'll have to make some of these key points. But the department covers 75,000 inspections, and that's on scales of all size, from railroad cars to pills. And in terms of in 65,000 inspections relative to food processing and agriculture products. So you can see just within Weights and Measures, not only is it recognized as a world-class organization, but it's important to our economy. The 600 companies that we provide calibration to, they find that this service is very, very important to their business. In terms of licensing, Sue Berg has run that area for 17 years. There's 349,000 Minnesotans licensed by the department. So that it's no small importance and covers an awful lot of lives. When you think about the different areas of real estate, the 34,000 that are licensed there, we have collection agents, 41,000 insurance agents, 86,000, 7,000 agencies, 1,600 companies, and I could go on. But the total is 349,000. That affects almost all of us. There again, you would think that that was not near as complicated or as complex as you might otherwise realize that it is. Just the background check on them all is not the same. The education requirements are not the same, and we have to approve the courses that are required in each of those cases. Four of those industries require that they have pretest to get their first license. One of the things that we focused on is trying to automate all this activity. Because as you can imagine, with the cosmetologists, the realtors, and others, there's not only a lot of licensing going on, but there's also a lot of movement. The mobility of our society and the relicensing and recognizing all that and keeping it posted for others in the industry and the public to refer to is extremely important. So those are some of the areas. The challenge there, frankly, is to try to get a lot more of that automated. In the past year, in 2003, we first automated the renewal process, and this year we had 28% of those renewals done on an electronic basis. In the Petro Fund, that's run by Jim Pearson. He's been with the department for about 10 years, and I'll be very brief, but it's the petroleum tank cleanup fund. There are 1,575 applications last year, totaling about $14 million. So it's not an insignificant activity. It's a very important activity within our state. The challenge this year we'll take up and may have legislation working here and within the committee because it sunsets in 07. In terms of the unclaimed properties area, another activity that maybe some of you, I know Pat Sexton looked through the list of legislators and found 17 or 18 of you that had unclaimed properties due from our department. But this covers a wide variety of activities. First of all, the money comes from checks from financial institutions, uncashed checks, payroll checks, and the like. The only tangible assets that we have management of are those that come out of lockboxes. And there are thousands and thousands of these activities. Last year alone, that there was $50 million turned over to the state from a wide variety of activities. But one of the new activities that bumped us up significant last year was $17 million came from demutualization of insurance companies. That's a new activity and a tremendous amount of new work for the department, but also $17 million is a third of all the money we took in last year. So we had to create a lot of internal systems, and frankly, I didn't mention that the area is run by Dennis Munkwitz, who's been with us for 14 months and came over from 9 years of activity in the finance department. But he's initiated a lot of things that will spread that work so that we can cover all this activity. Last year, we paid out $14 million to 7,400 claimants within the state. And since 1969, the department has paid out $143 million of a total of $225 million that's been turned over to the state. So you can see the numbers are pretty enormous. Because we are responsible for maintaining the record of every claim that we get, that total now is approaching a million. So that since 1969, there are a million claimants out there for the remainder of the fund, which is about $82 million. So it's no small task to keep up. We only have a few people doing it, and we'll probably ask this committee for a little bit more flexibility. As things have changed historically, as the case with a lot of regulatory areas, I find we don't keep up. As the business, that $14 million that we paid out last year was 10% of all that we've paid out in more than 35 years. So if in putting that in perspective, we have to take a look at it. It used to be that we were required to advertise in the newspaper. But we find now that we encourage more people to hit the website, and that's probably our number one way that people identify now the possibility of a claim from our state. But we still have 32,000 calls coming in to be handled by these six people to verify whether the claim is justified and then make a record of the payment out. I know maybe I'm taking more time, but as I said before, I really want to make sure that I cover this area that's very important in a more thorough way. In the financial exams area, Kevin Murphy was brought on staff in 1998 by an independent group, nonpartisan, because of his 17 years experience at the FDIC as an inspector. Kevin runs the department. Jackie Gardner started as a kid in 1973 in insurance solvencies. She does that work for us, but she came here after being in the state of Washington and Illinois, has been with our department since 97. She's highly respected throughout the company as being a real expert in insurance solvency. And more recently, we hired Bill Horlitz from the FDIC. He had 29 years experience there as an examiner, and he examines the state chartered banks, thrifts, and other financial institutions that come under our jurisdiction. And it's no small task. Those of you that are in rural areas, and I come from a rural area originally, we have 354 financial institutions chartered by the state here. And there's more than $24 billion in assets in those banks. Counting their branches, there are almost 800 branch activities. And so you can see the magnitude of the importance. And to do that, to build consumer confidence is one of the, obviously, the principal reason that we're out there doing this work. But also, the other activity that we try to do what we can to encourage competition in the financial field. In fact, the Minnesota, with 21 new branch banks in the last 4 years, ranks number two in the nation in the startup of new banks. So we think that in that regard that we're having outstanding success. In the area of insurance solvency. One of the best measures that I've come across is recently a survey that was done that covered insurance solvency or impairments from 1976 to 2002. Some states are as bad as 4 to 6% of their institutions that are impaired or insolvent. The national average is slightly under 1%. Minnesota's is about 0.3%. So we're about a third of the national average. One of the areas, too, that I think that we, to give some perspective to the way that we are perceived around the nation in terms of our solvency and our audit process. We started, our department started under Jackie's guidance, a process to look at the asset base, match that up against the business plan of the insurance company, and then measure the assets to see if the reserves are right and the assets match up against the reserve. Our first large job in that regard was last year. It was a large company. And when we sent the results around to the other states that depend on our audit, there was a fair amount of grousing, to put it mildly, because it was new and they didn't understand it. But that audit was more highly scrutinized maybe than any that we've done in many, many years. And the truth of it is that the proof was that our answer was right. And today, the likelihood of an endorsement out of the NAIC and a more common usage nationwide of our risk asset-based audit is likely to become the model rather than the exception. So with that, I'll move on to the market assurance area, where a lot more publicity is given and maybe more overall attention. But the area is run by Deputy Commissioner Pat Nelson. Pat's back at the department after being a deputy prior from 91 to 99. Great experience, good background. Gary Levesser is the assistant director of enforcement. Tremendous background and has been just an absolutely great asset to me and to the department. 27 years in the department, 9 in the police department prior to that. Very, very good investigator. And I'll only mention, because in a few minutes I'll cover the National School Fitness Foundation case that the department worked up, and I think that it's a reflection of the great work that Gary does or has done. In the regulatory environment, we have 36 people in enforcement. We have in the department 250,000 calls, about 68,000 related to insurance. Out of those calls, about 9,400 result in our opening a file. 4,400 of them result in an full-fledged investigation. From that, 600 approximately result in some kind of civil action. And when you think about, we don't have the ability to give tickets like the patrol does. We have to negotiate each one of these three settlements per day. Or civil penalties that are levied are negotiated. So they're time-consuming and they're important. But at the same time, if you put that in perspective to the 349,000 people that we regulate in all the industries, 600 civil penalties is really not an awful lot. But it is important, and our goal is to maintain compliance. Compliance, in our view, and the way that we like to view it, is that it has to be balanced, and it's a delicate balance every day to regulate business and industry so that both get the benefit of their bargain. And that's our goal. From these, though, I will give you a couple other statistics. The penalties last year were $6.7 million, very little of that from insurance. On the recovery side, though, for people that call in, we negotiate with the agent or agencies or insurance company to fulfill a claim. There's $4 million in recoveries was collected on their behalf or paid to them through our negotiation. And most of that was from the insurance companies. I could go on, but I'll move on to the insurance filing and analysis area where there's 16 people involved. And the one area, one thing that I'd like to point out there is we get an awful lot of filings, rates, and forms. And what we're trying to do is automate those. The important factor, I think, for this committee to be aware of, that there's a significant move to federalize the activity of this department and this committee. And when I think about it, and I've been in the position of being in business, and if I put myself in the shoes of a CEO in an insurance company, and I have to deal with, and it used to be that we had a lot of towns, still do, township insurance companies, community insurance companies, county, regional, state, but we deal a lot now with international, globally based insurance companies and national insurance companies. If I were the CEO of a major company headquartered here in the state, and I had to have the state of Minnesota's approval before I could go to the other 50 states to sell a new product into a new market to meet a new market, and it took a year, I would be frankly pretty discouraged. Our competitive states can turn around the filing in 1 day to 2 weeks, giving them some significant advantage. The other advantage they have is that their premium fees, taxes on premiums in most of the states used to be 2, but a lot of them are reducing it. So Iowa and Nebraska recently reduced theirs to 1. Premium income in our state is $199 million. So it's no small amount. But getting back to the federalization, and if I had to go to all 50 states, it would be an easy argument to go to Congress and argue that it ought to be federalized and made into a more uniform format. So one of the things that we're trying to do is to make it more electronic, more quickly reviewed, and more in compliance with the NAIC, so that they can get a quicker turnaround on a uniform basis and get to the marketplace. I'll not belabor that, but it really is an important factor and something that I think that all of us need to be aware of in an industry that's very quickly changing. Our challenges here are the broker's commissions. I didn't cover that, but it obviously has gotten a lot of attention this past year. The transparency there for brokers, I think, is critical. No-fault insurance, health care are a couple of the other areas. Two examples of activities from our department in the enforcement area that I will read just a couple of these items so that I keep them in context. The National School Fitness Foundation first came to the attention of the public through the Attorney General's office, referred to the auditor. The auditor did an outstanding job of sending somebody out and doing an audit over a 90-day period of time. Came to us and said, you know, we think that there's more to this and there's a possibility that there's fraud involved in criminal activity. Mr. LeBesser got it and took the responsibility largely on himself to move it forward. And from March, when the referral went to the auditor, to when it came to our department in May, till July, when Mr. LeBesser had this investigation concluded, took it to several federal agencies, and within short order, we were able to get a confession of guilt and 2 indictments out of the state of Utah. And the U.S. attorney for our district here, Minnesota, said that it was one of the quickest and best prosecutorial formed investigation that he had seen. The most important part of this is that we got the Ponzi scheme shut down in a very short period of time. And it did affect, I've forgotten the number, but I think it's 17 school districts, 30 programs, and $7 million in our state. But the Ponzi scheme was only beginning to roll up. It affected 20 states, $77 million, and 600 programs. And so to get them shut down in a relatively short period of time, I think is a significant benefit to the consumers of Minnesota and throughout the country. One other quick one. We did an insurance company investigation.
Hold on, Commissioner Representative Rukavina.
Maybe I'm the only one, but I know what a pansy is, and I don't know what a Ponzi is. What's a Ponzi scheme?
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. Ponzi scheme, basically, and they're probably, Mr. Levesser would be able to identify, but basically they never intended to pay out. And the new people buying into the scheme are paying the first ones in. And they just keep rolling it up, and eventually it folds. Mr. Nelson.
Like the Albanian pyramid scheme I bought into last
year? Sounds like it might have been.
Mr. Nelson, introduce yourself.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I can help you. For the record, my name is Patrick Nelson. I'm a deputy commissioner with the Commerce Department. A Ponzi scheme actually comes from the name of a fellow, Charles Ponzi, was the guy who originated this scheme, and it was a securities scheme where you take the later investors to pay off the earlier investors, and you need to keep building it to keep giving the earlier people the rate of return that you promised them, and eventually it collapses. It's a classic pyramid scheme, but the name comes from an actual individual.
Thank you very much. Commissioner, go ahead.
Continue on with just briefly the other important investigation that we were involved with that I think that goes back to the federalization issue, and it's important, I believe, that that it's understood. A major national insurance company doing business here were swapping out one product for another and taking advantage of the public. That was our claim initially, and then they were not handling claims appropriately. We started that investigation, pursued it. It was obvious to us that it was more than just a Minnesota issue, that it was a national issue, so that our state led a multi-state, included all 50 states, against this company. The settlement was a national one where we got, I don't recall the exact number, but something in the 300,000 as part of that penalty. But the important part is that because we felt that there was harm done to the consumers of Minnesota beyond the scope of the national claim, we held out and made an additional claim on behalf of the state for $250,000 and in addition to getting this company shut down, not shut down, but the activity changed in behalf of the consumers of Minnesota. So had that gone into a federal investigatory system, we would have lost the ability to gain the protection for the consumers of Minnesota for that additional area that we covered. I know this committee does not have jurisdiction for energy and telecom, but and I don't want to dismiss this because we have some outstanding people here and in our department. Mariah White, who is our go-to person in that area. I forgot our deputy. Ed Garvey is the deputy commissioner of energy and telecom. But Mariah White is our go-to person, great experience, good recognition in the industry. Mike Bull has recently joined our department as a strategic planning director for energy and telecom. We're really pleased to have him on board. And I'll skip the others. It'll be in my briefing document. But in terms of energy, we advocate on behalf of the public and at the PUC. We analyze utility conservation improvement program, which is a $97 million program. Many of you will get a copy of the report done recently by the legislative auditor, which basically, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but by and large, the money spent for conservation has been well spent over the years. That ought to be a relief to you as it was to me. And we spend a fair amount of time looking at renewable energies. Renewable energy in our state, as some of you may know, is today about 11%. It'll be 20% by year 2015. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but let me say this. The goal of the energy and telecom area, the energy area, is to provide for reliable, low-cost, clean, environmentally superior air. When we do that, we feel as though we've largely covered our bases. And the challenge in the energy area, frankly, is to look at more transmission and more generation over the next few years. Telecom, I'll summarize that. It's headed up by Diane Wells. But this area really, really needs significant regulatory review. Any of us know that we no longer have teen lines. We don't. Many of the kids don't have phones at all. They have cell phones. The landlines that we regulate by our regulated carrier have dropped from about 90% of market share to about 45%. And what's really important to Minnesota consumers is that we have a TAP program that provides $3 million worth of support for those that are poor and need to have phone service. We have the Hard of Hearing, that's a $5 million program, 24 hours a day, 27 days a week, provide hearing transcripts for people that are hearing impaired, thousands of people involved. Those programs are covered by landline support. And without that going forward, even 911's in jeopardy. So it is a critical area, and we'll be looking at ways to re-regulate that. In summary, let me say this. We continue to expand our online services, our website. I skipped over that briefly, but let me go back. We had, a year ago, 33,000 hits to our website per month. Our average today is over 100,000. It's making more information more available when our consuming public needs it. But we have a good ways to go in that regard. In terms of licensing, we've got to get more electronic, make that more easily done and available to the public. Lookups for insurance agents, where there's 67,000 of them and they change their lines, add companies, the ability to be able to look that up online is critical. There's 600,000 changes to that information a year. That's all got to become more electronic and more quickly available. So those are our goals going into this year. We're pretty proud and excited of some of our accomplishments. Let me tell you very briefly what some of them are. Since I've come into the department, we've reduced our space by 25%, more than $4,000 annual savings. We switched out an obsolete telephone system that was not able to be managed. Like I say, there's 250,000 consumer calls alone that come into the department. We were not able to track or trace or manage any of those. With the new system, we are. In addition to that, we save $108,000 a year. We've reduced our lines from 450 to 70, and they're managed through a computer voice-over system. In terms of the website, I covered that briefly. Our expenditures for our department, not inflation adjusted, not adjusted for anything. Our spending is down $1.5 million a year from 2 years ago, and that's after we spent $600,000 to move the department, add an upgraded operating system, and a widescreen, flat screen, because a lot of the business that we do requires that in the past our investigators and our policy people had to toggle back and forth page to page to do comparative analysis. By having a large flat screen, they're able to do it on one screen, so we made a major expenditure. $600,000, even with those expenditures in there, we're $1.5 million under previous expenditures. In the area energy, the largest accomplishments were the approval of the MERP system, the Prairie Island, and the XL service agreement. Expanding our capacity electronically has probably been the number one achievement in the department. I mentioned the fact that we have 28% of our SURF filings now electronically done. In terms of documents, we've converted 1,200,000 documents last year to electronic system, so that they by the second quarter of this year will be available to the public and stakeholders that need the data and information. That's about 100,000 documents. Anyway, I'll close with that. I'm proud of the progress that we've made. I'm excited about working with all of you to even have more progress in the near future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Commissioner Wilson. Any questions for members? Representative Sertich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner. I, too, have to applaud your folks that work in your department. I think they do a great job. I have a specific question. I have a constituent who has called me about long-term care insurance. He saw a raise of about 40%. That's going to go into effect. He got the notice a couple months ago. Can you comment on that issue and any movement that your department is doing to look at this at this issue?
Commissioner Wilson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative. That's a very, very good question, and it's no small importance to the department. I can tell you what the way that it came to my attention. We've had, after historically, a lot of companies providing this product to citizens of our state over the last good number of years, whether you've had a policy for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, it's not had an increase. 14 companies asked for an increase this year. The reason I know some of the statistics is because it is important in our department. They've asked for increases from 8 to 50%. It's the first time that we've experienced this request. And I've got to tell you, my first response to it was, holy smokes, I bought 3 years ago long-term care insurance for my wife and myself. The premiums in round numbers are $4,000. Had I been hit with the average of these increases of about 25%, then $1,600. My first thought was, my dad's 93, and my mom didn't die till she was 86. If I have to pay these premiums for 30 more years, am I going to be? How many more of these increases can I expect, and how big could they be? Because the likelihood of my being able to afford them when it actually comes time to need this product, I need to reassess what I did. And frankly, I'm probably in rather good shape to afford it compared to a lot of people. So I asked the department and our actuarial group to look at it. We're in the process of putting together for publication late this month a white paper on the subject. I know a lot of people say, well, why would you, or what's initially the cause? And I can tell you quickly. In those 20 intervening years, whether it's 5 or 20, it doesn't matter, two things have happened, good and bad. The lapse rate, meaning people that just quit paying after you pay in a bunch like me, I paid in 3 years, so I only have a loss potentially of $12,000. If I said to myself, I can't afford this going forward because I don't know how many more increases I'm going to have to cover. If I look at that, there's two reasons that come to my mind. The lapse rate used to be 39-40%. People at some point in time gave it up before they needed it. That was good for the insurance companies, but over a period of time, people have realized the importance of this product. And even if they can't maintain it, the kids say, look, Mom, let me help you pay it because it's so critical to the family. And so the lapse rate has dropped significantly. I don't know currently what it is, but it's down a whale of a lot from 39, and that's one thing that happened to the insurance company. The other thing, and I'm not making excuses, I'm just trying to look at the record for what it is. The other thing that happened is interest rates dropped to a 46-year low. The average return for bonds for insurance companies over that 20-year period that we're talking about was between 5 and 6% on average, using a AAA rated bond. Over the past 2 to 3 years, it's been about 1%. They never anticipated, never projected into their rates either one of these two events happening. and let's put them in a position. They stalled probably too long, frankly, in increasing the rates or applying for increased rates. That's what's happened. Fortunately, I think that from a societal point of view, more people keeping the insurance is a good thing. How much latitude do we have to maintain the premiums at the lower rates? Not a lot, because if in fact they need it, all the people that have been paying in for this 5 or 20 years now are up against it, because they've got to be solvent when the time comes that the claim needs to be paid. So we look at it pretty doggone hard, I'll tell you that. And I think that our white paper will do a lot better job of explaining than I have. But in a nutshell, that's the issue.
Representative Sturridge.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the explanation, Commissioner, and members. I mean, this issue, I think, cuts a few different ways. There are members of this committee, even like myself and probably Representative Coles, who probably wouldn't be buying this insurance with these rate increases going on and on and on. We have a better chance of getting hit by a bus, and maybe that'd be an easier way for us to get out of it. But we also, there are members of our communities.
I'll let you get hit by the bus.
Oh, okay.
Stick around.
we have members of our communities. The gentleman that has talked to me about it, he's, you know, in his late 70s. He's been paying in for many years. He's in a bind because he's getting priced out. He's on a fixed income. If he sees this rate increase happen over and over again, he's not be able to afford the insurance. But at the same time, if they don't raise the rate, there's no money there left for him to collect if he actually has this long-term care insurance. So I think it cuts different ways for different generations, and I think it's an issue we got to have a white paper on, but then we also got to look at helping these individuals that are already retired and been paying in and keeping true to this promise.
Good point. Representative Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Wilson, this may be another factor involved in that maybe you can take a look at, is do all companies charge an adequate enough premium going in? My concern is if you underprice that to buy business, and then as those clients get older, you raise the prices, you in effect increase your lapse ratio, if you follow what I'm doing there.
Oh, exactly.
That would be one of my concerns, is making sure that we require insurance companies to charge an adequate premium going in so that the people know what they've got 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now.
All right, Mr. Chairman, Representative, now we've got the real brains here. But once again, I will say that Julia Phillips and the actuaries that we have on board are nationally recognized for their ability, and that is one thing that we look at awfully hard. In fact, we may have a reputation of looking too hard, but it is an area that going in we look at very, very hard, because that is our shot. Pat, do you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, yes, maybe I could amplify a minute on just that particular point, and the Commissioner's right, the brains are back at the office. Julia Phillips is charged and works in my division for monitoring the rates. And the rates, the structure, what we look at in long-term care, were changed in 2001 because the NAIC and others could see that the pricing problem that the representative mentioned, that you can underprice this product and then get people in and get them to lapse. The standard has changed now to where we look to see if the pricing is adequate given moderately adverse experience. What that did, though, is cause the price of the new products, those filed with us and sold since 2001, and also since 2001, you have to have mandated that you offer a rider which is non-forfeiture, so that if it's expensive, but you can, as a customer, choose to give yourself some lapse protection, because that what that would mean is you get your money back if you did lapse, if you bought that rider. I don't want to push too much emphasis on that. I don't know what the penetration is there. But for the sake of what we do try and make sure that the rate is up to the point where these kinds of increases will be less prevalent in the future. But as the representative indicated, this, for the people that purchased and have had this product for a while, this is a significant problem, and we are looking at trying to figure out how to maybe manage that differently.
Representative Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'd just like to know what how much of your work in your department is outsourced?
Commissioner?
Chairman Wilkin, Representative. I don't know, but very little. If you look at the $215 million, I'd like to look it up and respond more directly. But we outsource some of the testing that the four industries that I mentioned, some of that's outsourced in the weights and measures area, the new liquefied meter testing, which has been a historical problem, that's now being outsourced, if you broaden the definition a little bit, but not a lot. I will get back to you on that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Goodman.
Did you ever complete the process of outsourcing your consumer phone calls?
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. No, we did not. I will have to say, though, that we do have a program going on right now. The notaries are going. The renewal of the notary license is being moved to the Secretary of State's office after this renewal period, and there's 118,000 of them. We did this past month outsource to a telephone company a method whereby we sent them a card they could call in and get a renewal over the phone by using a punch button. We just didn't have the staff and the staff up train and do it on a one-time basis, get it all done by January was not a reasonable expectation, particularly since it's being moved and automated over at the other department. So to that degree, yes, we did outsource, but it's pretty much a one-shot deal.
Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Commissioner, just a point of clarification. How exactly does the department regulate insurance?
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. That's a pretty broad question. Let me ask Pat to reflect on it and cover it more specifically.
Commissioner Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we regulate it pretty much by function. There's the function of company licensing. If you're going to sell an insurance product in Minnesota, you have to do it from a licensed carrier, which means you have to apply to Kevin Murphy's division and get pass muster to be sell products here. His division also looks at insurance company solvency. As the commissioner mentioned, the domestic regulator, which would mean an insurance company that we're the home state of, we're charged with looking at their solvency, and the rest of the states give our auditors some deference through the NAIC, which has a program of accreditation to make sure all the states have the training and experience to come up with good numbers in that area. In my division, we regulate the policy forms and rates. Different kinds of insurance have different standards there, but in effect, we look at the intake about what's sold to Minnesota citizens. Then another part of my division does what is called enforcement in three different methodologies. One is consumer complaints. We call it a CRT team. Their principal goal is try and answer your constituents' insurance questions, and if it's a problem that can be resolved with intervention with the insurance company, basically by phone or fax, we won't turn it into an investigative file. We'll try and handle it in an expeditious fashion, and it's tracked by phone logs. We use that in computers and phone logs. There's the investigative part of that, which is more complex problems or problems that may affect more than one constituent, so we would open an investigative file, and investigators would look into it and make determinations as to whether they're complying with Minnesota law. The last component of insurance regulation is what we call market conduct, which is an investigative group, and usually it's a team on something like that because these are larger scope investigations. The commissioner mentioned one on Newham that was just recently completed. That is something that we've either discovered through the other earlier kinds of investigation or through our contacts with other jurisdictions, that there is a, I guess for want of a better phrase, pattern in practice about something about the way they conduct their business that needs a bigger, broader examination. So those are the kind of methodologies we use to regulate insurance. All of that comes from state law. So the general answer to your question is, how to regulate insurance is determined by you folks here and the rules and regulations upon which they govern. Those are the tools we use to impact and to carry out what the legislature deems essential as to insurance regulation.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. Representative Hamilton. You talked about filing. Do you see an increase or a decrease in the filing?
Commissioner Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there's a decrease in the actual numbers of filings. There's an increase in how many we're getting, as the commissioner mentioned, the SURF system. I think more companies are going to that methodology, and I think that then has a tendency to simplify a little bit their product offerings. So we're seeing a little drop-off in filings. That being said, there's a lot more push in this particular function by companies who are under competitive pressure. They call it speed to market. And speed is, I guess, the key word there, as you're finding in everything. With internet time has caused everybody to want it better, quicker, sooner. And they are feeling like they're in competition with other types of financial institutions that had a lot of their shackles removed under Graham Leach Bliley. So that they are in more direct competition with other kinds of financial services. So there's increasing pressure on that division to be faster moving with its reviews.
Okay, Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner Nelson, on that speed to market issue, can you talk a little bit, have we seen improvements out of the department in terms of turnaround and getting forms approved and rates approved? Does the department have kind of aggregate statistics? Commissioner Wilson mentioned during his comments that some departments across the country are able to approve filings in a day or 2 weeks or a fairly quick amount of time. Where is our department at?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Calls. We're considered, at least we're told we're considered, we're slow. That might be good or bad depending on your point of view. We have internally made significant progress in trying to speed that up, and I think our average review time is now around 60 days. It is difficult to generalize about sort of form and rate review across the different jurisdictions, because while the law might say, you're this particular product line, and let's take homeowners, for example, which would be prior approval on the form and filing use on the rate. And that was probably, many states probably have, say, the same setup for homeowners insurance, for example. But what they consider when they look at it could vary substantially. They could just take it in and say, looks good, and homeowners is a pretty standard product. Some might have, there's five things we consider important in South Dakota, say, and they'll just look at those five pages and they'll stamp it out as approved. Whereas we try and look at, you know, the totality of the product, and we're sort of rethinking some of that. We're still improving our progress. We're doing some more. The SURF is helping us improve our timelines, but we're still, I think, criticized by those that are pushing for national standards. The commissioner mentioned the federalization of insurance. I think it's my thought that some of this will be inevitable because of the pressures of 50 jurisdictions on multinational companies, let alone, you know, multi-state companies. There is a lot of different reasons. One, their market conduct. You have 50 different states in there doing market conduct. You have 50 different jurisdictions on product reviews and rate filings. It's just not a very efficient way from their perspective to manage government's regulation of their business. There are a couple of different models for federal regulation that are out there that are active now. There's the SMART Act that Representative Oxley has in Congress. There's also a couple of draft pieces of legislation I've seen on sort of a dual federal-state regulatory scheme, more like securities is. Which way the body politic will go on that, I wouldn't hazard a guess. But the general feeling is, and the NAIC, which is the sort of the coordinating body for 50 jurisdictions, is working hard to head some of that off, and some of the things they're looking at are like producer compacts for form filing, so that maybe we could have, kind of like we do on the solvency side, have the home state look at the product filing, and then by sort of general standards, you know, approve it for Minnesota. Minnesota isn't part of that yet. There are, I think, about 11 states that are sort of in this infancy of a compact for form filing. But this whole area is undergoing, I think, you know, pretty dramatic change. And a lot of it's driven by, you know, some of this stuff is 100 years old, and government used to be like the repository for important documents so that people could, and that kind of thing, and we keep, you know, all the filings and things like that so that other people can come look them up. Some of the needs for what we do in that area are just changed because, you know, you can look up your policy on the internet. Many companies have it, or you could require them to have it. And so there are different ways to manage some of the functions of government. But like the rate filings, I think that, you know, that's important. It's important to local vision. So I think some of it will change, and some of it will, I think, continue to be under state jurisdiction.
Do you, Commissioner Wilson or Nelson, do you need authorization from the legislature to become part of the interstate compact?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I'm not 100% on that answer, but just knowing how the system works, I believe we do.
Okay. Representative Pepin.
Yeah, I'm wondering if, I have a follow-up question to Representative Hamilton. I'm wondering if you could comment just a little bit about how some of the other states regulate insurance.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. Well, my interaction with the NAIC is that the states actually have, I think, pretty much all of the same powers, a lot of the same rules and regulations. It's really in how they're carried out. Say solvency, for instance. Solvency is actually sort of governed by the NAIC because they actually send out an audit team that comes and looks at Minnesotans, how we do that job. I think it's once every 4 years or so, and it makes sure that we're still following the standards that would enable our work here to be accepted by the other jurisdictions. Now, even that area is under review. The commissioner mentioned that Kevin Murphy and Jackie Gardner's team has developed a new risk solvency criteria, which I think other states are finding to be intriguing. So it's not like that's a static area, but that I think the states are pretty similar because they use the NAIC to coordinate. Most other jurisdictions have some standards, as to say, form and rate review, that are that are encompassed in law. And in many cases, it's how those states choose to view what the responsibilities under their statutes entail. So that's why you get the 50 different, you might be looking at almost exactly the same words, but you get 50 different interpretations. And that's what in effect is causing companies to really rethink state-based regulation, particularly in forms, market conduct, and some other things that have unique jurisdictional peculiarities that aren't visible to some degree. I mean, it would be different if all the words said the same and everybody did them the same. They would probably be able to manage that. But what causes them, I think, a lot of efficiency problems is the fact that the words may say the same thing, but the application of the words is very different.
Anyone else? Representative Mull.
Mr. Chairman, would it be appropriate to ask a question about telecommunications in this committee of the commission?
It is not in our jurisdiction, so if you're unregulated, and I don't think there's the staff is here to...
I'll ask them after the committee then. Thank you.
That'd be great.
Yep.
Thank you. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, my question is just simply, I'm wondering if you could explain a little bit the division of jurisdiction between, say, the Attorney General's office and your department. I'm thinking of the enforcement that you mentioned, specifically the Ponzi folks. I'm thinking with one of the school districts. I'm just wondering where you overlap, where you don't, and how you decide.
Commissioner Wilson.
Chairman Wilkin, Representative, I don't know. Fortunately, we have a lot of seasoned people in the department that when they get these investigations, the calls or the write-ins, or in fact, a lot of them are coming in through email now, they do recognize and they're referred back and forth. I could be a lot more specific and ask for a breakdown of that for you.
I think that would be helpful for probably all the members of the committee to understand the different jurisdictions for consumer protection, where the complaint goes, because there is some division, but they also work together because the Attorney General is the attorney for the Commerce Department and the administration. Any other questions? That being it, next meeting is tomorrow. We've got the overview of the Department of Labor and Industry. We're adjourned.